Welcome to the Aerospace Advantage podcast. I'm your host, John Slickbaum. Well, you've heard it all year. The sky is falling when it comes to the F-35. Air Force leaders, members of Congress, and a host of commentators have really signaled serious concern with the program, especially when it comes to aircraft and engine reliability, plus its operational cost. Add in concerns with how long it will take to field the F-35 Block 4 software update, which is the advanced version that the services really want for the Pacific fight, and it's been a brutal year for the program. There's no shaping this one. Any reasonable person who's just been reading the newspaper headlines this year would wonder why we're still buying the airplane. So we figured it was time to dig into the issue and figure out what was going on from people who really understand the details of the program and frankly own much of the path forward to improved performance. The companies actually building the F-35. And this is not some infomercial to spin the status of the aircraft. Our goal here today is to, no kidding, talk about real issues, baseline problems for what they are, explore contributing factors, and talk about how we can make things better. Because here's the deal. America and its allies want the F-35 to work. And frankly, we all need it to work. It may be emotionally satisfying to have a tantrum about the program and make dramatic pronouncements about canceling it, but it's simply not an option. The Air Force's fighter fleet is too old, too fragile, and simply won't win a full-up war with a peer adversary. 80% of the fighters Air Force airmen are strapping into today were designed in the late 60s and mainly built in the 70s and 80s and have been flown hard in nonstop combat engagements going back to Desert Storm 30 years ago. Even when the jets are at home, the speeds they fly at, the Gs they pull, and the loads they carry match what we would see in combat. And oh, did I mention the fact that most of them spend their lives outside on the ramp and all sorts of weather? So yeah, it is time to reset the combat Air Force, and the time to do it is now. And the F-35 is the only fighter in production with the attributes we need to fly into harm's way, execute the mission, get home safe, and regenerate to do it all over again. So we must be brutally honest about what problems are getting in the way of the F-35 living up to its full potential. And we need to push fixes as fast as possible. Reality simply isn't going to allow any other option. Even if the F-35 were canceled today, it would take into the late 2030s to field another solution. Designing, testing, and manufacturing a new high-performance combat aircraft takes time. We'd also see a new slate of technical challenges emerge in the interim. So a perfect program doesn't exist. Now, added to all of this, we've heard from the operators. They want this jet and they respect its capabilities. So we need to get it right and boost F-35 production fast. Now, given the magnitude of what we're going to talk about, this will be a two-part series talking about the future of the F-35. So this week, you'll hear from the Mitchell team and Lockheed Martin. And following up next week, we'll dive in with Pratt & Whitney. So with that, let's first get some context with members of our Mitchell team. I've got Doug Berkey.
Hey, Slick.
Heather Penny.
Hey, Slick. Great to be back.
And Major General Larry Stuthream.
Hey, Slick. Great to be back.
Now, we're going to have a quick conversation about the current state of play. So, Doug, first walk me through the jet. It's not like this is some nebulous mass. It's a complex ecosystem of components that work together to form a total unit. So how do you conceptualize the jet when you're thinking about its health?
No, it's a really good question. You know, the way I look at this here is that you've got the physical structure. That's the actual element that forms the airplane itself. So just like you'd have 2x4s forming up walls in your house and sheathing and all of that, it's the same way for an aircraft. Then you've got computer hardware. And so just like the laptop sitting on your desk, modern aircraft have a lot of computer capability for processing on board. You've also got the software, which is increasingly important. It runs so many elements of the jet these days. And that's something that is always going to be updated throughout the life cycle of an aircraft. You've also got sensors in various spots of the aircraft. Traditionally it was just a radar. Now it's all sorts of different sensors that provide different data that the computers fuse. And you've got a data link, which is what connects you to the outside world and other actors in the battle space. And then obviously the engine is really, really big in terms of importance and its own level of complexity. And then past that, you've got hydraulic and electrical systems, and they really actuate everything. They're kind of like the lifeblood of the aircraft. And so it's really important that when we hear critics talk about the F-35 just being totally broken or this or that, I mean, no, It's not like that at all. You know, think of it like your body. It's not like you go to the doctor and say, I am totally broken. The day you say that is the day you die. It is a piece of you is having an issue. So you might have twisted your ankle or you might have a cavity or whatever. And so it's the same thing with any jet. There's a particular piece, component, that is having issues that needs to be addressed. And so it's really important to dial into that because you can't solve it effectively unless you diagnose it. And so that's why when we talk about issues with the F-35, both what is working well and what is having challenges, you got to laser in. And then you work the problem from there.
So Heather, I get what Doug is saying, and let's be honest, being an airplane owner, I get what it means. You know, when I think about my simple siren as a series of systems working together to make the airplane fly, I don't call the mechanic and say the entire airplane's broken. I tell them the system that I'm having an issue with, and we focus there, and then it gets fixed. So walk me through what the services are citing as main problems with the jet.
So Slick, we need to understand that there's really no single type of F-35 in service. We have the different variants, the Air Force, the Marine Corps, and the Navy variants. And furthermore, as the aircraft have gone through production and the continuous improvements and modernization, newer systems have been added as they come available. So the guys flying the early build jets at Eglin are experiencing totally different problems than the guys that are flying at Hill. And those are the newest jets. So it's not a surprise to anyone that the early jets are those that have the biggest set of problems. So when we're talking about problems with the F-35, we can't treat it like it's just one big thing. You have to ask very specifically about which F-35 variant are they talking about and what production block they're citing. So the good news is that the structures and the core aircraft systems, like the hydraulics or electrics like what Doug was talking about, these are all doing really well. And as a matter of fact, the jets at Hill are performing outstanding. And this is crucial because it's the physical redesigns at that level that are really tough to implement, not only to retrofit and fix, but to reinsert back into production. The challenges that the F-35 fleet is facing right now is keeping the line jets healthy. These are the modern ones. It's really coming down to engine reliability and the host of early design parts that are on the older aircraft, like those that are at Eglin, and spares parts availability writ large. You can boost spares, but it's the core things like engines and computer processors that require design enhancements. So some of this is known and is already in the works, and others are still in development.
Stets, Heather mentioned aircraft blocks. What does that mean?
Well, Slick, this can be a bit confusing because historically the term model, and I'm putting my fingers around that word in quotes, was used to label a significant variation of a fighter type. We'd normally talk about an airplane through model numbers such as Model A, Model B, Model C, Model D, and so forth. For example, for the F-16 that I flew, the first model was the F-16A. It was the first batch of single-seat fighters for the F-16, and it was a beauty, Slick. The F-16B model was an F-16 configured with two seats for training pilots to fly with an instructor pilot in the back seat. The C model of the F-16 was a substantial upgrade to the A model that included better avionics, weapons, and even some adjustments, I believe, for aerodynamics. But the F-35 labeling breaks with a long history. For F-35s, those letters denote different F-35 variants that Heather just referred to. The Air Force operates the F-35A, the Navy operates the F-35C, and the Marine Corps operates the F-35B. And it's always going to be that way. So a choice was made in the F-35 program to use the term blocks to denote improved capability benchmarks. So block 3F is considered the baseline combat capable block, and we are building those now. Block 4 is the ultimate goal for the F-35 force. Now, a jet's ability to be upgraded between blocks comes down to retrofitting newer things, like I said, computer software, sensors, and so forth. The F-35s that will be purchased with fiscal year 23 money, now that's the budget that will be submitted to Congress next year. Those F-35s will be at a level of configuration with core systems like computers and sensors that will be Block 4 compatible. Earlier blocks than 3F will need upgrades in some areas, and the scope of work depends on aircraft age, of course. The earlier the block, the more that needs to be updated to get them to Block 4 level. But once we buy these new jets with that fiscal year 23 money, it's primarily now a software update. No kidding, somewhat akin to how your smartphone updates.
And statistician, I'll jump in here. I mean, we deal with this stuff every single day, and I can't tell you how many times I have to call up an expert over in the Pentagon or whatever and ask, okay, what is this block? And it's not just a block, it's the sub-elements of it. It's crazy. And I think one of the huge problems here for people that are responsible for oversight with the program is that there's no leveling. And so it just seems like an emotional black hole where these jets are constantly on this spiral of improvement. You never quite get to a goal. And that was one of the benefits of the A and the C for the F-16. You knew what an F-16A was. That was really good. And you knew something was going to be better. It'd be the F-16C. See the level set. And that just, people do not get that. I mean, when we're up on the Hill or media or other people like that, it is an alphabet soup of this stuff. And I think any future aircraft has got to have a far simpler way to track the programs. Otherwise, it feels like you're never hitting goals because people can't understand the goals because, you know, we're talking to you about the main blocks. There are about 20 under each one of those. It's just crazy at some point in time. I got it made sense to some engineer on a spreadsheet 20 years ago, but this is insane. You know, senior leaders, folks on the Hill, this is nuts. So we've got to change this for the future.
All right, team, lightning round. Give me one thing people should know that is affecting the F-35's reliability.
So, like, I'm going to jump in here and say the first thing is the Joint Program Office. The Joint Program Office is a large bureaucratic structure, literally over 3,000 people that manage the F-35 programs for not just the services, the Air Force, the Marine Corps, and the Navy, but also for all the partners and all the foreign military sales. As a result, the services, the partners, and the foreign military sales, they lack control over their program because it's the JPO. That basically, the JPO pulls it all together and then divvies out things like spares based off of really Byzantine rule sets, right? So even though you might fund for spares, you might not necessarily get the spares that you want. And as a consequence, because training jets and training operations are a lower priority than, say, deployments, anytime you're doing training or training operations, that's training at Luke or training at Hill, you don't get the same spares priority. So not only is it an issue of how the Air Force is able to address availability, but it also is a huge overhead imposition.
Now, and Heather, just jumping in on that. I mean, think of it like a general contractor for your house. You've got your subs, your plumber, your carpenter, and all of that. But if your general contractor can't keep schedules straight and keeps losing cash and all of that, I mean, you're going to find a new general contractor. And the JPO's track record here is not great. So I completely agree with you. The other piece I think that's huge with the way the program was built is that they ran spares really thin, both for the airframes and for the engines. And I think there are a lot of reasons for that. People are very optimistic. We also remember went through sequestration. So people are looking to cut cash any way they possibly could to get programs to survive. And we're now hitting to the point where it's all coming due. We got to get back to realistic spares. And it might not be that a jet really has any issue. It's just that it is waiting for a part. Therefore, on the tracking mechanism, it looks like it's down for a week. Well, there's nothing really wrong with the jet that much. It's just waiting for the part. And so yet the aggregate number gets downward indexed in a way that makes it look worse than it really is. So those have got to come back up. And that's a funding piece. I mean, Congress can fix that pretty easy.
Okay, folks, let me give you a big one. And it's critical to understand, especially to those who compare the F-35 to other fighter aircraft. The F-35 needs to be regarded as a different standard than, say, the F-16 or even the venerable F-4 or Phantom I flew as a lieutenant. And here's why. The F-35 sensors are integrated into the overall aircraft design. The F-16 and legacy fighters, on the other hand, they use bolted on externally podded sensors for things like night navigation, jamming, sensing of all kinds. Now, why does this need to be clearly understood? Well, legacy fighter models are bought and sustained completely separate from those pods they carry. The bookkeepers fold integrated sensing costs into the F-35 aircraft ledger. So do you see what I'm saying? This drives a higher perceived unit cost for the F-35. It's not a good comparison. It also affects by the way, the F-35's reliability numbers, because it ties sensor health to the overarching aircraft mission capable rates. Again, this is unlike how mission capable rates are measured for legacy fighter types. The aircraft health for legacy fighters is tracked separately from the status of those sensor pods that it carries. So this is a case of apples and oranges comparisons, Doug, as you were saying earlier. And if F-35 analysts and pundits don't understand this, if they're not careful, they're going to misrepresent comparisons between various fighter types.
You know, Slick, I got one more thing that folks need to know, is that those early jets, the ones that are at Eglin, they are a totally different configuration. And so they have to be managed, they have to be spared, and they have to be maintained in a different way, and they're seeing different trends than we are with our modern aircraft. So it's really important that we, as soon as possible, that we up the rate of production so that we can replace those early jets for two main reasons. One isn't just the reliability and the maintainability, so we've got the same configuration across the board, but it also allows us to make sure that we're training our pilots in the same way that we're doing modern.
And that's the same way we've done every single system. You didn't see Block 5 or 10 F-16s hanging around too long.
Exactly.
Yeah, you know, I'll jump in and Doug, I'll say when I flew the F-16A model, it didn't even have weapons capability that could compete with a lot of other fighters that were out there. That came later in the program. But they got the aircraft out there. They found all sorts of things about it that needed to be improved, including flow blocks on the engine that stalls at the worst possible times in air combat maneuvering. So the F-35 is on a much better track, but it's very much in parallel with previous fighter development.
Well, team, I appreciate all the background. And next, we're going to hear from Audrey Brady, and she is the Vice President of F-35 Global Sustainment at Lockheed Martin. As many of you know, many companies build parts for the F-35, but ultimately it's a Lockheed Martin design and they put all of its components together. So Audrey, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me, Slick. It's great to be here with you today.
Audrey, we know aircraft platforms have a life cycle just like other major weapon systems, and they have a design development phase and a production phase and then a sustainment phase after they're fielded. And we hear a lot about the first two, but not always a lot about the third. So given the headlines, sustainment is causing a lot of concerns in the F-35 world. So from your perspective, what is sustainment and how do you define what happens in this phase of the jet's life cycle?
Well, sustainment is everything after the aircraft is delivered to the field and everything that it takes to keep the F-35s in the air and ready to execute the mission for the warfighter. So anytime and anywhere that aircraft is deployed, it requires close partnership and collaboration with our ultimate customers for the lifespan of the F-35. So we really appreciate that feedback because we incorporate it in everything that we do. And that's really what sustainment's all about. It is parts, but it's maintenance, it's supply chain, it's logistics, and really much, much more. The end users of Lockheed Martin's sustainment capabilities and services are U.S. and allied logisticians, maintainers, crew chiefs, pilots. I mean, we are committed to delivering what they need to do their jobs, you know, to execute their mission. And frankly, the most important thing is to come home safely. So one of the ways that we do that is through fifth generation sustainment capabilities, including predictive health, high reliability, and high velocity supply system, and condition-based maintenance.
Yeah, I really appreciate mentioning the international partners. And that's something that we, you know, from a holistic standpoint of talking about F-35 is, of course, we focus on our three services, but we can't forget about, obviously, the eight partner nations plus the others that have bought the jet. Well, Audrey, another question that's been dominating headlines is what's working well with the aircraft and where do we need to improve? And given what we've been talking about, let's look at this by the major blocks.
Well, as an aircraft manufacturer, nothing makes you happier than hearing from those who fly, maintain, and support the aircraft. And I'll tell you, I've taken as many opportunities as I can to visit the bases, the training facilities, the support locations, both foreign and domestic. And I did just that, just really, really listened to what are those challenges, right? I mean, first of all, the overwhelming feeling and the overwhelming response was that the aircraft is performing as advertised. I mean, really, frankly, they love the aircraft. But no one was shy to tell me also what we really need to focus our attention on. And we take that feedback to heart, and we're not shy, certainly, to also bring back those challenges to our teams and action those items. That's really what's most important. But today, the complexity of it all, the F-35s are operating from 21 bases around the globe, more than 1,460 pilots, and over 11,000 maintainers have been trained on this aircraft. And the F-35 fleet has now surpassed over 430,000 hours, which is just absolutely remarkable. And most importantly, it's performed extremely well in combat and brought our pilots home safely every time. But clearly, again, there are areas of improvement, and we've heard loud and clear from our customers that we can need to continue to drive down costs. And that's really one of our most major focuses in this area, you know, and specifically in the area of sustainment. We're laser focused on doing just that. In fact, we've actually reduced our cost per flight hour of the share that Lockheed Martin owns by over 45% over the last 5 years. And we're projected to reduce it by another 40% by 2025. But we're also partnering with the services, our industry partners, to pull every lever that we can to reduce sustainment costs, while also keeping in mind that we have to increase mission capability rates. So we owe it to the customer, we owe it to the American taxpayer to continuing to lower the cost. And we are dedicated to do just that.
Audrey, how do you measure aircraft health and what do you do with this data?
In cooperation with the Joint Program Office, of course, we track multiple performance metrics for the global fleet that direct indicators of not only the aircraft health, but also the health of the support system. Again, like I said earlier, sustainment is all about the entire system. So a primary metric used is mission capability, and that measures how much of the fleet is currently flyable. Year to date, that performance is about 65.5%. And this data feeds multiple improvement initiatives and projects, including reliability and maintainability improvement projects, readiness improvement project initiatives, and other engineering directives that we, you know, bring into our system. So another metric that speaks to sustainment performance is the mean flight hour between failure rate. And that is the time the parts remain on the aircraft before they're needing to be repaired. The F-35's mean flight hour between failure rate is performing well. It's really more than twice that of the fourth generation weapon system.
Yeah, that's pretty incredible. You know, mean time between failure. For those that fly airplanes, you know that's a big deal. And you know, I have a 1944 Stearman, so I know I had an oil problem last night and I couldn't go fly. So I totally get that. Now that we're balancing requirements of the large international F-35 community, what are the biggest challenges and opportunities in sustaining the global F-35 fleet?
So as I stated earlier, F-35 is certainly a very complex program. We have three U.S. services that carry a lot of influence. We have eight partner nations. We have six other allied nations with a single acquisition customer, the Joint Program Office, right? So you can really imagine the challenges that come along with that many customers and that many stakeholders who, I mean, don't always necessarily agree on all of the decisions. I'm very fortunate. I have a great relationship with my JPO counterpart at Apollo. He comes from industry, so he understands the challenges both from, you know, the government perspective as well as the industry perspective, which really has made for a very effective working relationship, and I appreciate it. But on the F-35, we have the benefit of a global supply chain that provides Lockheed Martin the ability to aggregate material demands, leverage our buying power for production, development, and sustainment, and really drive down the material costs with the large volume of the global fleet offers. So in some cases, you know, we've been directed to use some specific sources for repair, transportation, logistics that, you know, you know, have limited our flexibility and our ability to move parts around the world to meet the customer part demands. But, you know, we're working through those things, you know, and certainly collaborating with these sources and the JPO so that we make sure that collectively we get better, you know, and certainly with our experience, you know, that really helps, you know, with those challenges. But we want to make sure that we're ensuring we're making the best decision for our supply chain going forward. And the multiple customers and complexity of the program, it also drives challenges with, you know, frequently changing requirements. Certain times contracting delays and funding shortfalls, which, you know, ultimately impact the warfighter having the capabilities that they need when they need it in the field. What we have done to mitigate some of those challenges really is to advance fund procurements ahead of contract so that we can protect supplier lead times, program schedules, and that way we can ensure minimal impact to the warfighter, overcome some of those earlier challenges that I mentioned. Ed and I are really committed and focused on shortening the contracting timelines and streamlining some of those processes. But, you know, what will help in the future is what we're talking about now. Longer term contracting instead of these 1-year models that we've been working in and, you know, having to find, you know, some of those other opportunities to mitigate the risks. In fact, there's a great example of how a global spares pool is working for the warfighter. In 2019 at Hill Air Force Base, the F-35As were operating from 6 locations simultaneously, including a deployment to the Middle East and a multi-country trip through Europe. During a part of that European trip, an F-35 needed a part while it was in Italy. On a legacy fourth generation platform, the unit would have had to wait until that part was shipped from Utah. And thanks, you know, to the global spares pool on the F-35, the spares part was delivered that same day from a warehouse in Italy, and the Hill personnel were immediately able to continue their mission. And this type of solution also drives cost out of the program on a daily basis, as there's one pool of spares and one repair system, which increases the efficiency, you know, for the F-35 user.
Well, you mentioned them before, and some of my favorite people in the Air Force are the maintainers, having been a prior enlisted maintenance guy myself. But yeah, a major piece of innovation with the F-35 is the predictive health assessment. And can you talk to us about what this is and how it changes the way in which maintainers keep the jets in the air versus older legacy airplanes?
Absolutely. I'd love to talk about that. You know, prognostics and health management, or, you know, what we say PHM, I mean, it's a truly a game changer for sustaining an aircraft. It's the primary system that detects, isolates, and predicts the aircraft failures through its high performance diagnostics, which is really the descriptive of the current state. And then the high value prognostics, which is predictive of the future state. And those capabilities combined really help that maintainer. And as with any air vehicle or aircraft, you have the scheduled maintenance part, like, you know, changing oil, checking tire pressures, replacing a part that's reached the end of its life, or unscheduled maintenance, perhaps like your example last evening that you're planning to fly and you had to replace a part that was not scheduled to come off. The unscheduled maintenance part is what can really slow things down, because it sounds, you know, just like that. It's not on the calendar. It's not scheduled. You know, it's not planned. So there's no really way of exactly knowing when an issue is going to come up. But the PHM really changes all of that for the F-35 maintainers and operators, because it enables condition-based maintenance, or CBM, which means regularly monitoring the condition of an asset to help decide what maintenance should be performed and when. And you can combine that with a lot of other systems that you want to check at the time, right? So what that does is it leads to more optimized maintenance and affordable readiness. And PHM provides predictive health indications, and that minimizes unscheduled maintenance in total. And when unscheduled maintenance comes up, it's really much more efficient because you have the parts, you have the systems, you have the repairs available when you need them. And those capabilities, they allow optimization of maintenance task sequencing and supply planning. And so you know which maintainers are needed, when you're going to need the spare parts, and how to prepare for that. And it also produces a more precise fault detection than ever before as well. Certainly you hear about Switchtronics, you're not sure what component is causing the fault. This actually zeroes in on those parts that is needed. It really drastically cuts down on the maintainer's time and, you know, the time that's spent on troubleshooting to locate that issue. And it certainly helps from the hardware and the component removal process. So it's getting results today. It's machine learning, it's artificial intelligence algorithms have already produced more than a 50% reduction in unscheduled maintenance and a 20% reduction in incorrect fault indications and hardware component removals, which really is significant. And that sustained reduction in maintenance man hour rate has really made a difference. It also helps us to point us in the direction of where we should be focusing our engineering investments as well.
Now, Audrey, we hear a lot about Alice and Odin, and what's the difference between them, and how will this evolution impact the predictive health maintenance, also known as PHM, work?
So Alice and Odin, again, the logistics information system for the F-35. So Alice, over the past 2 years, there have been measurable improvements in Alice. So those improvements in Alice first include the software development spans. They've been reduced from a 12 to 18 month span down to an average of 3 months. Second, it also, the software development costs have been reduced by 70%. And finally, Alice software rollout costs have decreased by over 60%. So the primary purpose of both Alice and Odin really is the same. The F-35's logistics system for maintenance, health, diagnostic, supply, fleet management, the difference is that Alice was initially developed over 15 years ago and really is limited. It's outdated technology. It really needs an upgrade. And Odin, which is the JPO-led effort and a collaboration certainly with Lockheed Martin together, it's intended to replace Alice. And Odin will be designed to take full advantage of the latest software, latest hardware tools, processes, technologies to support F-35 maintenance actions, with the goal of improving maintenance efficiency and in addition to improving inventory management and responsiveness. And today, the PHM, as mentioned earlier, that capability is incorporated into Alice, which provides F-35 maintainers to access aircraft health information right through the system. This information enables maintainers to determine what appropriate maintenance actions could be performed and when maintenance actions should be taken.
You know, I know we hopped right into talking about this predictive health, maintenance and things like that. And just for the listener that, you know, might feel a little overwhelmed with the acronyms, you know, the bottom line on this is, you know, when I flew the F-16, I would come back from a mission, I would, you know, look at all the gauges and how the flight went. And, you know, when I was about 10 minutes away from landing, I'd call maintenance and say, hey, we're about 10 minutes out and I'm code 2 for hydraulics. And they would say, oh, okay, I guess Slick's going to have a hydraulic issue with this plane. Or, you know, the guy's going to have to, you know, wheel some test equipment out there, figure out what's going on. Or, hey, I'm code 1, meaning there's no issues that I know about with the airplane. And then, you know, likely just do a normal turn, you know, a gas and go for the next go type of thing. But, you know, when the F-35 is, you know, coming back to base, it's electronically sending the health of the airplane to, you know, not only maintenance, but also the logistics supply chain saying, hey, you know, this airplane's going to need tires and, you know, 3 more flights, you probably want to start getting that stuff off the shelf and put into shipping. So I just wanted to kind of clarify some of that and make sure that the listeners understand what we're talking about here. But I quickly want to transition into talking about something that's really cool, which is the fact that the F-35 is obviously a stealth aircraft, and this technology has had its own fair share of flight line sustainment challenges. So what did you all learn from past stealth technologies, and why is the F-35 so very different? And as I understand it, it's part of the jet that's, from a maintenance standpoint, going very well.
So Stealth technology, it certainly continues to evolve and evolve quickly. And we continue to learn how to better, more efficiently maintain stealth aircraft. That being said, it is a quantum leap from early stealth technology to today. From a low observable technology standpoint, the F-35 is in a class all its own. And from a stealth maintenance standpoint, the amount of time needed to maintain stealth aircraft continues to improve. We actually spend very little time on stealth maintenance, and due to the unique mission requirements, the F-35 and the resultant stealth characteristics, the F-35's composite construction requires the use of sealants and adhesives for work that has been really historically requiring rivets and screws. So the cure time that's associated with these products can extend the required repair time, but you know, with these added cure times, the F-35 still requires the lowest number of maintenance hours required per flight hour than any legacy fighter. So in the end, you get a stealth aircraft with lower maintenance hours per flight hour and much more than a non-stealth aircraft. And we are aggressively pursuing new compounds that have faster cure times while still meeting the environmental concerns associated with the chemicals. For example, we've recently qualified a new sealant that reduces the cure time from 48 hours to only 4.
Yeah, you know, for those of us that were around during the, you know, F-117 days, you know, if you had dropped a tool on a wing or something like that, that could be a really timely and costly repair. So it sounds like you guys are really on top of the outside of the airplane, which is the cool part. Another thing that I wanted to ask was, as you look at the jet right now, what are the biggest reliability enhancements you're looking to implement? And how does this break down between jets on flight lines versus one coming off the production lines?
So there's a number of components and improvements that are being made to both reliability and maintainability. For reliability, there's more than 50% of the parts on the aircraft have never failed in more than the 430,000 flight hours that I described earlier. And a total of 92% of all aircraft components are exhibiting reliability that's above the engineering initial projections. We're always looking to improve the maintenance of experience. And in one case, we've changed an electrical bonding process that reduced cure time from 24 hours to no cure time being required. I mean, that's absolutely huge. It's a huge improvement that allows for immediate regeneration of the aircraft for its next sortie. And we're also paying close attention to fleet activities. Again, like I said, we're always looking for that constant feedback. And so in this case, we're modifying panel fastener locations and installation processes to prevent corrosion. So, you know, limiting the number of times having to go into these panels, but also making it easier to go into those panels. And one particular improvement involving the aircraft hoist point cover will soon be fielded and will be fully broken into production at LRIP 15. A large percentage of the reliability improvements that are delivered to the fleet are actually introduced into production first, well before the entire fielded fleet recognizes those same benefits. And you really do that for a reason. It's due to the nature of the F-35 program, which typically opts to fly until it fails and then replace with the new improved part. And that mentality, as opposed to, you know, grounding the whole fleet, install the new improved part. I mean, in the long run, you know, it allows for higher continued readiness as you're, and you can, again, you know, going back to the scheduled maintenance, you can do it on a scheduled basis and do that, you know, increasing the improvement and increasing the reliability, but, you know, slowly integrating that into the fleet to also keep those costs down.
All right, Audrey, I've got one last question for you. And what we are aware of is recently as 2 years ago, some of the DOD analysts were predicting that the F-35A's average cost per flying hour for 2020 through 2035 would be about $44,000 per flight hours. And that's in fiscal year 2020 dollars. There have been media reports on the new sustainment deal between Lockheed Martin and the Joint Program Office that says this will be much less by 2023. So can you briefly break this down for us?
Yes, I'd be happy to, Slick. The continued drop in cost per flight hour is a great success, and a lot of great work by the F-35 Enterprise has made it possible. With the recent FY21 to 23 contract agreement, the JPO has said that they anticipate the Air Force F-35A cost per flight hour will be down to $29,000 per flight hour. And in 2012 dollars, and that's in comparison to the 2012 dollars by 2023, that's an improvement from the $33,800 at the end of 2020. So it's important to note that the JPO cost per flight hour metric includes additional costs beyond, you know, the 39% of the Lockheed Martin contract scope that I was referring to earlier. So it includes operations support costs for the Pratt & Whitney engine system and the U.S. services to incorporate the remaining percentage. And of course, I'll defer to the JPO to talk further about the program-wide cost reduction predictions. But now the annualized 21 to 23 sustainment contracts with Lockheed Martin represent more than 30% reduction in our portion of the cost per flying hour from the 2020 annualized contracts. So this is an improvement. This is an important next step in further reducing overall operations and support costs, which are shared between government and industry. And Lockheed Martin has reduced our portion of cost per flight hour, as I stated earlier, by 45% in the past 5 years, and with, you know, predicting us going an additional 40% by 2025. But really, bottom line, driving down the cost, it's a team sport, and we remain committed to partnering with our customers, with our teammates, you know, other partners in the industry to do just that.
Well, Audrey, I can't say thanks enough for you taking time out of your busy schedule to talk to us today. And as a guy who flew the F-16 and was an F-35 core pilot, I know the progress and the capabilities of the jet. And we really appreciate what the folks at Fort Worth are delivering to the warfighters.
Thank you, Slick, so much for sharing your personal experiences, but thank you also for your service.
Thanks for listening to part one of this two-part series. Next week, we have leaders from Pratt & Whitney who are going to talk about the F-135 sustainment, the powerhouse of the F-35. With that, I'd like to extend a big thank you to you, our listeners, for your continued support and for tuning into today's show. If you like what you've heard today, don't forget to hammer down on that like button and follow or subscribe to the Aerospace Advantage. You can also leave a comment for us to let us know what you think about our show or areas you would like to hear more about. As always, you can join in on the conversation by following the Mitchell Institute on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, or LinkedIn. And you can always find us at MitchellAerospacePower.org. Until next time, this is John Slickbaum. Stay safe and check six.